Welcome to the World of Women Create podcast series, where we bring you the magical and innovative worlds of artisans and makers from the pages of our magazines, Where Women Create and What Women Create, along with special guests who are entrepreneurs and experts in their fields. We love to share great conversation with extraordinary women, women you may be very familiar with and others you may not know. My name is Jennifer Blott, and I am the editor-in-chief of Women Create. It is my pleasure to welcome you, our listeners, and all of our guests as we explore the ups and downs, challenges and triumphs, exhilaration and immense joy of living a creative life. A creative life is a life that's rarely stagnant and always leading us down surprising paths. Thank you for being part of our creative world, the world of Women Create. Hello, today I have the great pleasure of speaking with Astrid Tauber. Astrid is a weaver, spinner, garment designer, and the founder of Unique Astrid. She also has the distinction of being Women Create's youngest featured artist. We shared her story in our summer 2023 issue of What Women Create when she had just turned 14. But the dress project she completed for the magazine and the story she wrote were done when she was 13. Astrid is an absolutely amazing person. When she was 7, her mom signed her up for a series of craft classes at a local store. She says, little did she know, all these years later, that she would be a girl who can shear a sheep, spin balanced yarn, and weave her own fabric to create garments with. Astrid says that fiber was a chrysalis that took her from being a painfully shy girl who looked like a deer in the headlights anytime someone approached her, to a young woman who has found her voice and the confidence to be heard. Welcome, Astrid. It's great to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me.
It's wonderful to reconnect. It's hard to believe it's only been about 6 months since we featured your story, but I think a lot has happened in your life, correct?
Yeah, and it's crazy that it feels like I did all that work and made the whole process and everything, but it was months and months and months ago, even before the article came out, that once it was like this exciting new chapter for it to get exposed to the real world, because it hadn't been yet.
We loved the dress you created. Will you just for a moment tell us about, I know the inspiration, Ebony Bennett, was that the artist's name?
Yes. She particularly does a lot of paintings based on Australian birds. And this one was based on the Australian red-tailed black cockatoo, which is a gorgeous creature, but her painting itself just had these extra details that were like the perceived version of the natural bird that I wanted to try and do that in my own fabric because it was just so magnificent. And that way I could take it and take that inspiration and add details that you would only see in a dress, but at the same time, try and represent this bird that's so incredible that most people haven't seen if they live in the States to the best of my abilities. So
it was gorgeous. And actually, have you ever connected with Ebony? Does she know that you were inspired by her work?
Yeah, we chatted a bit about it, and I still follow her work very closely, and she's an amazing artist, but I don't think we have discussed it much since.
So are you a freshman in high school? I know you're homeschooled. Are you considered a freshman?
No, I'm technically in college. It's weird.
Tell us how this works. I know you're also doing design courses in college and homeschooling.
Yes. So technically under the category of homeschooling, you're unschoolers. Okay. It's just like a more niche version of homeschooling, but I don't go to school, so it's at home. And I usually just say I'm in college because it's easier than explaining unschooling and everything else, but that's what we're here to discuss. So let's discuss it. I haven't gone to school, like a proper school, since I think the first grade until last year, or this year, I think, when I started going into college. So that's quite the like transformation to go from not going to school for 8 years and then suddenly being in college and having very high expectations for a 13-year-old. And it was an interesting journey, but there's no like decent label for where I am school-wise. It's just I do the things I enjoy and somehow learn from them. But we can chat more about that as well.
Well, Astrid, everything about you transcends labels. So the college classes you are taking, are those online? You're logging on every day and meeting with other students remotely?
Yeah, it's in Vancouver. And they have students who go in person, but then they also have an overhead camera that all of us that are online, whether we're in the US or also in Canada, can join and learn the same format just without having to be in the room. And so I've taken 2 of 4 semesters already. I just finished my second. First is design and illustration. And then I just finished pattern making. And then my second 2, I get to decide. But I'll probably do branding and marketing, and then I haven't picked for my 4th one. But it's some different Canadian system that pretty much adds up to an associate's, but it's based on certificates. So I get a certificate for each semester. And then once I have the 4, they're considered like core 4. That is a diploma, basically, but it isn't technically an associate's because of the way that the Canadian school system works. I didn't go for that reason. I went because I wanted to learn those technical skills in that type of setting.
You are also running a business, a small business, correct? You're at craft shows, you're selling through Etsy. Tell me how you manage your time and how you're able to do all of this.
So all of it for me ties back into school. I mean, I started my business at like 9, I think. And it was solely because I wanted to be able to all the things I was interested in. I now own 3 looms that are almost entirely self-funded. I think one of them my mom freighted home because I was trying to fit it in the car and that was not going to happen. So she paid to have it freighted home. And so I was able to pay for those. I have sewing machines that I have 2 siblings that if my parents say, all right, fine, we'll spend on a $23,000 loom, then they'd have to do that for my siblings. And that makes no sense just to do that for a loom. So they were always saying that we'll help you get to the point where you have those resources, but we in no way, shape, or form can just give you thousands and thousands of dollars to go do this. I mean, who can? So instead, they, mostly my mom, helped me initially build a business where I could just make the things I enjoyed and spend my time, you know, like right now I'm researching Tyrian purple from Murex snails during the Roman Empire. Like there's some really weird things that I find interesting and appealing that the typical teenager wouldn't. And yet I can take time and the energy to do that because I have my own business. And that way I can go ahead and research all these crazy things and enter in, you know, weaving competitions around the world and all kinds of different things, including social media, that I wouldn't have the opportunity to if I didn't have my business, if I didn't have magazine opportunities like this and social media and my parents too, of course.
And speaking of social media, your Instagram account has 128,000 followers.
Somewhere around there. Yeah.
Okay. Please tell me when you founded the account and how you grew it. I am sure so many of our listeners would love to know. That's an astounding number, even for an artist who's been practicing for many years.
I started with Facebook, as many do. And the curious thing is that weaving doesn't actually have that big a demographic on social media. It's just the two of them don't jive well because you don't really see that much textile art and weaving and things like that, especially the way I do on social media. And so it just became a matter of posting what I was doing, except for magazines, because then obviously I can't share it for months and months at a time. It was really something that I started with Facebook and grew. And then during the pandemic, I was like, I might as well give it a shot. Like, what could go wrong if I just start putting what I'm putting on Facebook on Instagram now, and tried Reels. I think one of the important things was I started trying Reels when Reels became a thing, or like when Reels became popular. So instead of now when there's such a massive world of competition when it comes to videos on Instagram and trying to grow and trying to get monetized and whatever else, that when you start pretty much at the beginning, then there's such little competition that if you have something that people find interesting, there's not 1,000 other videos like it. And then it very randomly grows. Like I had a video summer of 22, I think, that hit 60 million views or something, 50 or 60 something, right around there. And that got me pretty close to where I'm at today. And I had no control because honestly, that video is very similar to most of my other content, but that's because it worked. So I don't really try too much at Instagram, but it seems to have worked. And I don't know if that's just because I found a really niche thing with less competition than you typically find. I have no idea. I am not an Instagram genius by any sort. It just works for me. And occasionally you will have something that works even better than you'd ever expect. And then you just go from there.
Now, do you set up a tripod in your phone to film your own videos and reels, or do you have someone else help you with those?
I usually have someone else help me because, I mean, I've taken video content all over the place. Like, I've been to the local farmer's market, and weaving is a weird thing to position around, mostly just because it's a lot of movement and a really big space. So
is that a friend or a family member who helps you with these?
Usually my mom, sometimes someone else, but.
And speaking of your mom, does she take you to the events? I mean, I'm guessing with the loom, you need a fairly good size vehicle to get that to the market. Or tell me the logistics of everywhere you need to go and how you're helped through your family.
I really just need one thing from when I do in-person events, and that is a driver because I don't have a license. So most of it I can do on my own. I have a mobile shop that I mostly created because I couldn't drive. So I have to load my parents' car or get help loading their car and then have someone drive me and then have help unloading and then loading it back up. It just logistically did not make sense when you don't have your own car or the ability to drive. So I made a trailer that's pretty much the smallest trailer they sell at Harbor Freight and some bookshelves off Amazon that I built around this tiny little, it looks like a doghouse basically. And I wanted it to have this like cottage style and whatever, but incredibly small so that it would fit into a 10 by 10 space. And I wouldn't have to pay for anything massive, especially when I was doing outdoor events. So it also has the storage that I need, as well as having a display I need. So the back door, it comes down into somewhat of a ramp. And that way I can keep everything I could possibly need in there, including the loom. And I have a fairly small-ish, it's really not that small, but in comparison to the average loom, it's small, loom that folds. And so it fits in there perfectly with like extra inventory, a chair, and whatever else I might need. So once I have someone to take me where I need and unhitch, then maybe I need help unloading, but that's pretty much it. It's amazing that I have this own unit and I can pack it up. I can, you know, be in charge of it for hours and hours and hours and just do my thing and weave and talk to people about weaving and textiles and all things strange and creative. And then I just need someone to drive me home at the end of the day. So this year I did the Somerville Farmers Market for, it runs from beginning of April till end of November. So it's like 30 or 40 weeks or something like that. And that whole time, my dad came and dropped me off because he's a morning person and my mom is not. And then my mom would come and pick me up when it was over. And I usually had packed up or would have help packing up or whatever. But other than that, I'm in charge of myself for hours and hours on end and my own stuff and bloom and whatever else. And it manages really well.
You mentioned Somerville. You're in Somerville, South Carolina. Do you have a vibrant arts scene there? Do people know you? Do you have craft festivals?
I've only lived here for about a year. We moved here October of last year. Yeah, it was peculiar because I didn't know we were moving until the summer. Within a week's notice, like papers were signed and like that was that. So it became this big shift, particularly for this project, mostly because I'd been wanting to do it for months and months. And then this article gave me the opportunity to like do it as grandly as I wanted to. But that meant I had to do it while I knew we had like a steady place to live. And the artist scene here is not a lot of hand weaving. There is a guild near me and is a small guild. And I say that mostly because it's not a lot of weavers. It's a fiber artist guild in general. So you've got like knitters, a couple of spinners and felters. There is a lot of artists events. Like, for example, there's Christmas Made in the South that I did just a couple weeks ago. That was amazing. But they do them all around the South. I think they do like 7 of them or something. And I just did the one that's near me, so I wouldn't have to have someone drive me for hours and hours just to vent somewhere.
Once you have a license, you're going to be traveling far, I'm guessing.
It's not really practical. I have no need to do it. Like this year, because it was my first full year, I did a lot of different events. I started with the farmer's market, but the farmer's market, I think you get like 3 or 5 outs for the season, and then you get like put on probation or something. There's a lot of strict rules. And I would call out, I think I only called out once or twice, so that I could go do other weekend events that were full weekends or whatever it specifically was, just for a lot of extra work for the possibility of doing better than I know I would have done at the farmer's market, and also having a booth fee that's way, way higher than the very original one. So sometimes it was worth it, but generally speaking, I would just stick to the farmer's market, which is convenient because it's like 10 minutes from my house. So I can go, I have my routine, I know my people, people expect me to be there. Like it's good and I like it and it's consistent. So I'd probably just stick to that if, like, for me, logistically, it makes sense.
So I wanted to talk about, I know your Etsy store, you sell some of your smaller products, little eyeglass cases and zipper pouches, correct? What am I missing? What else do you sell?
Not a ton. Headbands, most of that. I have a separate inventory for Etsy and the farmer's market, usually just because it runs for so long. And the vast majority of what I make, which is the same products, but all in my handwoven. And then whatever other handwoven things I have go on Etsy. Like I keep like maybe 20% in Etsy and then the rest in my trailer.
Now, do you have to consistently go to the post office to mail things or do things get picked up? I'm just even thinking of the logistics of running the business and sending out packages to people.
I think they come and pick it up at the house.
I believe in your story, when you created your dress, you said it took about 100 hours. I just think that you would have a great market for custom work, but that takes a lot of time. And do you foresee yourself doing a lot of custom dresses for people, custom garments?
About 4-ish years ago, I decided that I would probably never do custom again, which is a weird thing to say because I was 10 at the time. Because when I started weaving, I think I was about 10 when I started weaving. And so a couple months into it, I was mostly using it as a tool to make money, which is strange, but it was because I had massive goals that I had no way to pay for. So I was weaving and doing a lot of custom stuff. And I spent all that time with this gorgeous loom that I could not make the things that I actually wanted to make because I was so busy making things for other people, making specifically what they wanted when I knew I had all these things that I would rather be making. Not that I had any issues with what I was making. I just would have enjoyed doing what I wanted to do. So instead, I was just completely lost to the idea of custom and specifically seeking out money or in orders and custom, all that stuff. That instead, I switched to, well, I'm going to make the things I want, and then I'm going to make extra fabric and turn it into product from that, which usually comes out in the form of bags and eyeglass cases and headbands and whatever else is on my Etsy. That was my way of, well, if I'm gonna, like the cockatoo dress, for example, for this article that I did, I made it to my exact dreams that I possibly could, and then took whatever extra that I had made and set aside for that and turned it into product, which, because it was for a magazine, I actually didn't have that much, and it was such a massive dress. But that's my typical process, is I just, like, right now what I've got on the loom is for the Hand Weavers Guild of America conference next summer, and they have put on a fashion show full of handwoven garments every year, or every other year when the conference is held. And I made this dress to, like, just the wildest thing I could come up with. It's based on a lion's mane jellyfish that I such enjoyed learning about this creature and reading about how it lives its life, that I wanted to take that information that I had gained and do it justice in the form of a garment, while taking all these technicalities that I wanted to explore and put it into a dress. But then at the same time, I'm also making maybe 2 or 3 yards of extra fabric that I can turn into a product. And I mean, not time-wise, but that will be what pays for that garment and for the time and energy that I put into it that I really didn't need to be paid for in the first place, but it means I can continue doing it.
You seem to have a really great sense of practicality for your business and sort of how to juggle maybe your passion projects with things that help bring in the money. And do you have a business plan?
It is entirely based on follow your interests. Like, do those really crazy, nerdy things that no one would think of attempting, and take that and go and learn it and spend time on it and explore it to the best of your abilities, and then see how you can afford to continue doing that. That is pretty much my system. I do very few extra events. I have gained a lot from social media, including some amazing partnerships. I'm affiliated with Burnett Sewing Machines, and they're amazing to have been able to, like, find me, and I don't even know how to put it well, but that they gave me such an amazing opportunity that I could just continue learning what I wanted to learn and exploring it. Pretty much everything I do is about having a learning experience when I get to the end of it. It's not necessarily to be the richest weaver who ever wove, but just to be able to keep doing that.
Have you been journaling this sort of path you've been on for the past 7 years?
No. I mean, I guess the best documentation that I could have would be articles and social media, because you get to see how that effort adds up. That one article is equivalent to all those hours and hours that I put into it and whatever else that goes into it.
So I want to hear more about shearing sheep. Do you do this for everything you work with?
From the person I originally learned to spin from, who was amazing, especially for the fact that I was severely under the age limit for the class. I think I was 16 and I was 9 at the time, but told people I was 10 just so I could get into the class. I went, I learned, the teacher was truly amazing. It was one of the best experiences. And then I was able to, I think I rented a spinning wheel from her and bought just an insane amount of practice fiber that I could just work on it like crazy. And she lived in Asheville, North Carolina, and I lived in North Carolina at the time as well. And we drove out to Asheville, and a friend of hers who was this elderly woman who lived alone but had 4 sheep because she wanted company and didn't want to have to mow her lawn, which I thought was the cutest thing ever, that she was able to have company and a lawnmower and friend all in one. We went to her place with the 4 sheep and learned to shear them by hand, and then went back to her place, and then I got to see her farm. She has, like, Highland cows and, like, hundreds of sheep and alpacas. It was amazing. And processes it at a mill, I think, but still teaches a lot of hand spinning, so it is a lot of hand spun yarn. And it was just truly a wonderful experience that I got to go and see this person and learn and gain that experience without having to have a career as a shearer, because that sounds stressful.
What is your favorite part of the creative process?
Planning.
Okay, I was going to say, is it the dreaming up the idea? So it's the planning.
The project I'm currently working on, which I think you could definitely say is a passion project, I spent, I think, about 8 months planning it before I started. And I was doing other things as well, not just sitting down every day and starting to plan it. But that way I could take things from life that would apply and process those into ways that would make it a better garment. It truly is one of my favorite things that I've done to date. It also has been a very intense thing to spend that much time planning something and put that much thought and effort into it, and then just sit down and have to do it is quite intense. This is the longest that I've ever spent planning something, although I've come pretty close. I am absolutely enjoying the process, but when you spend that much time perfecting the idea of it, to have to actually make it is interesting.
And do you ever find yourself in the middle of a project and say, I'm done. I just don't want to complete this. This is not what I thought it would be. Or it sounds like you bring everything to fruition, but do you?
I have to. Yeah. I would never be able to just abandon something midship, which this one, my mom tried to get me to abandon it because it was taking a lot of energy. And I just had to see it through. When you spend that much time literally just thinking about something, you have to make it a reality. Like, it's too much just to leave an idea alone for the rest of time, or you have to complete it.
So tell me, where your space at home, do you create in your room? Do you have a dedicated studio?
I do, mostly because no one would want to listen to it. We've been in this very loud process. So I have my own 12x16 shed in the backyard. When you have a household of 7 people who work from home, school at home, pretty much spend all their time at home just because that's where we have our spaces and our processes, then you need a lot of space. So I do probably spend more time out here than I do in my own room and sleeping, but that's just because everything could need is in here. Pretty much everything is out here except for one of my rooms, which stays in my bedroom.
Your family sounds very, very supportive. Tell me how they've encouraged you and supported you on this journey.
The topic of privilege comes up a lot, especially on social media. I realize that, of course, I'm privileged, but that doesn't mean that I got to the point where I am because it was spoon-fed to me. It's because I wanted to learn information that it probably isn't typically taught, and wanted to seek these abnormal things out. And the privileged part of that is that my parents let me, and they had the resources to let me instead of putting me behind a desk for hours and hours every single day where I would learn the exact same thing as the person sitting next to me. Not that I have anything wrong with that. It just wasn't suited to my family and to what I wanted to do. So it isn't something that most parents typically plan as, you know, my kid's going to be a weaver and they're going to shear sheep and spin their own yarn. Like, my parents never thought of that, or my grandparents or anyone beyond that. So it wasn't something that was like a family trade. It was very much something that I sought out because I was curious, which is our learning process of unschooling, is if there's something peculiar that you're interested in, pursue it and see what you can make out of it. That's what my parents let me do. And they helped me find the resources so that I can do that. And partially why I'm in college is because then there's someone to get better at helping you find those resources, where if you have parents who have never done it and only know it through what you do, then it can be hard to find some strange resources. And so you have to go out and find them yourself, like going to college at 12 because you wanted to learn pattern making in a very formal setting where you sat down every day and just started learning pattern making. There's been many experiences like that where my parents just let me go. And it's a strange thing, but it also means then having social media and going to the farmer's market, because those are incredible learning experiences. If you're listening to this podcast, you probably have. If you've ever had to start a business or start a social media account or an Etsy, whatever it may be that you are trying to, you know, fund your dreams or fund whatever it is, That is an insane learning experience that most people don't go through until their adult life. So my parents are amazing at supporting really strange things that I've gotten into that are definitely not typical. I mean, maybe if I was an adult, it would make more sense. Because I was so young, especially when I started, that most people would look at it as a hobby and see it as, yes, this is an amazing interest, but let's prioritize the standard education versus let's see what this can be. And just, that's my very long explanation. But generally, that's what my parents have helped support me with.
It's interesting because many of our women create artists write their stories for us when they're older and they're looking back at their creative journey. And a lot of them went on to do more sort of practical careers and came back to art either when they retired or when they had just some sort of epiphany. But so many of them will say that that creativity and that desire planted itself when they were very young, whether it was 7 or 14. I think a lot of us know who we are at a young age. It sounds wonderful that your parents supported it. Are they creative?
No, my whole family has really strange interests. My dad works for a car company and in marketing, which is incredibly convenient to me because he's this like genius when it comes to marketing and went to MIT. And then my mom is an educator, and I don't know what her title is, if she has one, but she teaches on a platform called OutSchool. She teaches confectionery arts and social studies, but generally that's what my parents do. And then my two brothers, older and younger. My older brother is into a lot of different stuff, but is very good at all of it. Woodworking, 3D printing. And then my younger brother is this like cars and math genius. Like I think he takes math 5 or 6 years older than he should be at.
So if we're thinking of traditional timelines, if you're 14 now, where would you anticipate being when you are the age most people go to college after high school?
Yeah. I will have, it's like I said, it's some weird Canadian system for schooling, but I will have pretty much my associates before my 16th birthday, which is only 2 semesters away from now. And then I will spend 2 years after that working on the Certificate of Excellence, which is from the Hand Weavers Guild of America. It is a program that goes into all kinds of technical-based weave structures, and it follows, basically, it's this handout that's literally only about 30 pages, which for 2 years of study is not that much. But the goal is you go out and find your own resources. So it'll say, you know, one particular structure, and then they want 2 samples in that type of structure. And then they'll say, go out and find your own resources. Like, you have to design it and you have to weave it, but you can go out and seek this information and learn from other people's designs. Most of the people who've done it have made a little over 100 samples, and that's completed within the course of 2 years. And then you submit it anonymously with all your research and information and samples and all these insane levels of notes. And then you get back a score for each of the samples. And if you pass, then you have the option of moving on to level 2. Level 2 is full independent study. It's another 2 years where you make as many samples as are necessary for what you're researching. If you complete all the way till the end of level 2, the label is Master Weaver. I have the goal of, if I'll graduate right before 16, then I'll start the COE and hopefully have it completed roughly by when I turn 18. Then from there, I can decide. I mean, that's 4 years from now. I think I'll decide 4 years from now based on what my interests are then. But I've already looked at PhDs overseas in textiles. Central St. Martin's and Harriet Watt both have PhD programs that you can take for textile-based things, and it's all independent study.
So career-wise, what would be your goal? Where would you see yourself? You're 14. So where would you see yourself at 24? You have a career currently, but let's say 10 years from now.
Take what I'm doing, which is, you know, having crazy interests and just enjoying weaving, and do it where it's all entirely handwoven still, but not even necessarily by me. It could be done by artists all around the world, because I mean, how else are you going to produce that much cloth by hand? And turn it into, I guess the term would be luxury goods, such as bags that have leather work and include handwoven fabric, and shoes, which I've already started learning shoes, and I've already made a pair of shoes, and I'm planning my next three, where even if I were to start doing clothing, like on a runway type of clothing, then someone would be able to purchase, I guess, as a luxury good, a pair of shoes or something that matches the fabric you see on the runway. The same way when I post a garment on social media, right now I'm able to say, well, here's a link to my Etsy where there's a bag that's the exact same fabric as this, but just small scale and reasonable to people in the greater part of the world, theoretically, so that more people can enjoy it. And rather than one garment, that is the limit to it. If I create a garment, I want all kinds of people to enjoy it, not just on social media, but that they can have a piece of it in their home, or you know, be able to enjoy it on a day-to-day basis. But it's entirely handmade, and it's something that I actually put time in because I wanted to learn some strange thing and have a learning experience by the end of it, that then someone can have a piece of that, and just that on a bigger scale.
Well, and you keep touching on this idea of handmade. The idea of purchasing handmade artisan goods means a lot to a lot of people. You know, I have a teenage daughter, and so many teenage girls are interested in sort of fast fashion, disposable items, and it kills me. How do you feel about fast fashion? How do you feel about these mass-produced things where not a whole lot of care and love went into them?
It's tough to describe, but they're made for a very different reason than what higher quality goods are made for. I guess the question more is, should handwoven or handmade goods, I should say, be a common household item and something that everyone should be exposed to? Or is it something that should be labeled as luxury goods and should be kept at a higher class? Or, you know, however you want to put it, it's more of a social thing, I think, than how it's actually being produced.
Tell me what something you've created, what it feels like to hold a garment that you have created basically from scratch. What is that tactile experience like?
Just this peculiar thing where people will often say, like, I wonder what it'll be like, or, you know, I can't wait to see. And I'm like, I usually know what it's going to be like. I'm a very detail-oriented person, and I tend to have very specific intentions for what I'm going to create. It's not usually a shock or a marvel, because I know the time I put into it. I know the effort and thought that went into it. But I also know that all that effort and thought went into making this a reality. I tend to think through each step, which is really what I enjoy about planning. But then it also makes it to the point where once you see a real life piece that you already know, because you knew all the options that you could have taken to make it differ. A lot of people talk about like satisfaction of seeing like your hard work put into something like that. And I don't get any of that. I enjoy the process more than I enjoy the final results usually.
Now, how about when other people see your final result? What are some of the compliments and comments you've received on your work?
There might be too many to choose from. One of my favorite ones, though, is I entered something in a fashion show last summer, and it was a conference. So there was this full fashion show dinner that was amazing. So it was this massive, massive fashion show. And at the end, I was in the hotel lobby with my family, and someone comes up to us. I wasn't even wearing like a name tag or anything, so they didn't know I was part of the conference. and came up and was like, did you know that dress, that red dress, was made by a 13-year-old? I'm like, I was that 13-year-old. Thank you. It's amazing to see like people's recognition. And like sometimes too, I think it's even more fun to exceed expectations, because most people's expectations is that a 14-year-old wouldn't even be in that crowd and wouldn't even pursue an interest like that. And so then to do it is all the more fun.
You know, when I was working with you on your story, you were one of the most professional artists I'd ever worked with. And right away, I think when we started working together, I completely forgot how old you were, because you were so professional and organized. And the way you're speaking about, you know, your planning and detail oriented, that came through. And what's really interesting is the entire time we were working together, it never once clicked that you are the very same age as my son. You're sort of, like I said earlier, you transcend sort of labels and age. And that is a beautiful thing, because people, I'm sure you found, people do want to box you in. They want to sort of understand, how can this woman be 14 and create these things? And I love it. Everything about what you do, the unschooling and your process, I'm sure most of your life you've realized you are different in the very best way possible.
Yeah. You know? It's very interesting, the expectations of a 14-year-old, which are usually based on reality, and teenagers in general, that people base it off what they know, which is a standard teenager. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I am definitely way too weird and nerdy to be a standard teenager. So then when you reach the point where they realize your age, it's even more fun, because people would never expect that from someone my age, which is kind of fun, when I really only did it because that was my way of learning and enjoying the process and exploring something new.
Well, and how do you stay motivated? How do you stay motivated to continue to grow and take on new things and expand your repertoire?
I do not find it difficult to stay motivated. Part of the reason my mom teaches us the way she does is she worked for a pharmaceutical company for quite a few years, and all her best friends too worked at the same place. And she said she woke up every morning wanting to throw her alarm clock against the wall. And she was like, I'm not going to want that for my kids. Like, why would I? So she has this thing that she likes to say, that is, if we want to go, you know, dig water wells in Africa, or, you know, become a lawyer, like, it really doesn't matter. Just as long as you can have a sufficient life for yourself that you can, you know, be able to afford to go and dig water wells in Africa and just spend your time enjoying the things you want to do. We reached a point where I was like, okay, that's what I'm going to do for my kids. I'm going to let them just do whatever they're interested in, no matter how abnormal that is. So yeah, I think it's worked pretty well.
Your mom sounds amazing.
Yeah, she's pretty cool. Definitely not the typical, like, as a homeschooler, it's interesting to converse with a typical schooler, because there is a big difference there, not good or bad, but when you are raised in such a different way, then to have a conversation with someone that is completely different to yourself, like just the way you speak and everything, it becomes very strange. So I can't even imagine what it would be for a parent who took that leap of, let's go like as far from this as we can, to, you know, talk to someone who is doing that. Like, I think that would be weird. It's almost a language barrier. It's peculiar, but I don't know what that would be like for a parent.
And can you see yourself, if you have kids someday, following a similar pattern with your own family structure and your own unschooling for your kids?
Probably. I think the most difficult part of it, though, is if you do have a kid who pursues something weird, like my brother, for example. Neither of my parents know anything about woodworking or 3D printing, and it just doesn't relate to them. But it works amazingly for my brother that they ended up having to go out and find someone who was better at getting those resources, just because they're more exposed to that world. And that's kind of, I'd say, the biggest challenge is.
Now, what do you do for fun? Like pure, like goofy fun, not not even creating, just teenage fun?
I love this question because I tend to disappoint. This is fun.
I knew you'd say that.
Yeah.
I've always in like interviews and stuff, people will be like, so do you like on the weekends, like, I don't know, like go hang out at the mall or like spend time with people your own age? And I'm like, sometimes, but it's not really what I enjoy doing. If I want to have fun, and like I've been researching spidroids, which are spider silk proteins, which is a very weird thing to be researching at 14, but it's pretty insane, some of the things that I found that have nothing to do with the typical teenager. So how would I then go and go to a movie or something that nobody has a clue what you do or gets it in any way, shape, or form? And they don't have to get it, but it then is weird to go hang out with someone who understands like 2% of what you do. That's a weird thing.
So do you go to mainstream movies ever? Are there any movies that are out at the cinema that you like?
I just saw Wonka. Like, that's it. It's the first time I've been to the theater, mostly because of the pandemic, but also because I just don't go to the theater. So, yeah, I mean, I don't really do typical teenage things, but I have almost never had an interest in doing it. I have one friend who's my age, who's my best friend. I mean, I have other friends my age too, but my best friend, and he currently lives in New Jersey, but he's a year younger than me and does the same things, but also has like the standard typical education of public school, and he's about to start high school and all this stuff. Me and him have been researching Murex snails for possibly an article in a couple months. And that's not something that then, you know, you walk up to a teenager on the street and they'd have a clue what that is. Not that I expect them to, but it's just very different then to interact with someone like that. So me and my best friend get along amazingly. And he's very much into the cultural aspect of weaving as well as historical.
So tell me, what's on the horizon for 2024?
I have a bit of a list, a bit of everything. I have goals for me are mostly things I want to learn. It's not like numbers for how many followers I want to reach or, you know, what I want to do in sales. Like, I am not very good at keeping track of that to begin with. So one of them is to focus on shoes, which I started taking. It's like an online recorded course through a school in London called I Can Make Shoes. And I've already done my first pair and I'm now like completely stuck in it and just like obsessed. So I'll pursue it so that basically when I make an item of clothing, I can make shoes to match that are out of my own fabric. That's one of the things I'm working on. Finish my last two semesters at the school I'm currently at. And this is quite the list that I made. Intern at Convergence, which is an event next summer. It's a joint like conference that Complex Weavers and Convergence are at the same time, same place. They're just back-to-back weeks. And I'll go and attend Complex Weavers and then intern and exhibit at Convergence, or I'll have something in the exhibit. Structural embroidery class with someone named Meredith Woolnough. It's this freehand embroidery where you do it in water-soluble stabilizer. And when you're done, all that remains is the stitching. I also now have a job which is fully related to this. So I design weave patterns for a textile company in New York, which is fun because I get to just like explore ideas and structures and design things and sample things, and it's so much fun. And then that becomes, I think, mostly placemats that will go to a lot of your like big box retail stores type things, Home Goods, Marshalls, Walmart.
How did the job come about?
They messaged me through my website. They found me on Instagram. So one of their employees, who I've never met and actually have no idea who they are, found me on Instagram, and then had their boss, now my boss, reach out to me through my website and was like, let's talk. So then I was able to pursue that, and they've been doing it on like a lot of the designing on their own for quite a while. where they'd have like a reference and then have it's all produced overseas. Then they'd have them, make changes or whatever their preferences was, and then that would become the final result. Versus now it's designing from scratch and having it from a weaver's perspective who's, woven things, because none of them have ever woven anything, which is fine with them. If you want to like go crazy in textiles, then it helps to have a weaver. So I'm excited to explore that and have fun with that. And then I'm hoping to write, I've already got one article submitted or like accepted. And then I submitted another one for Ply Magazine, which is a hand spinners magazine. And now I'm actually looking at a third one. So yeah, that's what I'm up to for 2024. I have definitely a lot going on.
Sounds like it keeps you invigorated versus stressing you out.
A bit of both sometimes, but mostly invigorated.
Do you do feel stress once in a while if you have a lot on your plate?
I mean, you just break it down into bite-sized pieces. I mean, I enjoy deadlines. I wouldn't be able to accomplish anything if I didn't have deadlines. I would just kind of be in limbo. But I do mostly try and make sure the things that I'm doing suit what I'm interested in. And so I make sure that these suit my ideas. So when I submit a proposal for a magazine, I'll base it off something that I've been curious about for a while and have been wanting to do. And then that way I've just got like a reason and then a deadline to commit that much time and energy into something. And that's that. It's all catered to my interests and the things that I enjoy spending time on.
And I saw on your website that you have a way for people to buy you a cup of coffee. Will you tell me a little bit about that?
That started when I was trying to buy a loom, which I now own and I'm staring at. I actually did a couple things when I started that. I think I made a coloring book too. So stuff like that. That was just little ways for people to support me who knew me on social media, who sometimes didn't have a reason for a bag or, the money for a bag. It's kind of like busking, basically, is how I put it, where I'll put up a video and then say, here's my buy me a coffee link. So that it's not all the time, but occasionally someone will be like, here's $15, have a good weekend, which is a strange thing that we would have never had before the internet. But now that we do, it's quite convenient to artists and social media users because it's actually really well suited to that.
Well, we always like to end the podcast by asking a question. If you were to host a dinner party with five guests, living or dead, creative guests, most likely, who would they be?
I made a very long list for this because I have a lot of people that I enjoy researching and learning from. And the first would be William Henry Perkin, who was the chemist who discovered the formula for synthetic purple dye. And the Perkin Medal is one of the like big chemistry awards that is based off him. And then John Galliano, who was a designer for Dior, mostly because whenever people think of Dior and it's like classic Dior, they think of either John Galliano or original Christian Dior. Simon Pierce, who did a research project that ended in a garment that is made from spider silk from the golden orb weaver in Madagascar. And it took 5 years, $500,000, and 1.2 million spiders worth of spider silk to accomplish this garment. And he was the textile historian, along with his American business partner, who went into it. Marianne Stubenitski, who's an amazing weaving designer. I legitimately don't even know if she speaks English, but has written multiple books and is just a truly incredible designer. And then Madeline van der Hoogt, who is a writer, weaver, and just true technical genius, and has also known some of the greatest weavers and all kinds of different things. That yeah, those are my people, multiple of which are dead, because the Perkin Award has been around since like 1870s or something like that. William Henry Perkin literally found, he was trying to develop an anti-parasite and was dyeing all his equipment purple on accident while doing it. And ended up discovering the first synthetic formula for purple and one of the first like ethical uses of purple dye for textiles.
Well, you taught me something, so thank you. It has been really, really wonderful speaking with you today. You are an inspiration. I've learned something. It's been wonderful just these past few months following all of your initiatives and everything you've been doing. And I hope we get a chance to follow up with you and do another story in the future. I hope you stay in touch. I know that you're an inspiration to me. So thank you.
Gosh, this has been amazing. I love chatting about my work and just being able to explore new things. So thank you for this opportunity. And this was an amazing chat.
Thank you again for joining us today for our World of Women Create podcast. In a world filled with endless stories, it is our mission to share the memorable personal journeys and lessons learned of the extraordinary women in our community. Their stories are stories that enlighten us, inform us, and ignite the creativity that lives in each of us. Women Create is grateful that you are part of our creative world.